Support for NPR podcasts comes from Bose, offering Bose in-ear headphones designed for comfort and quality sound and featuring soft silicone tips in three sizes at bose.com/radio.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. Tonight, a lot of us would have been glued to our televisions to watch the stars parade down the red carpet at the annual Golden Globes Awards in Hollywood. But actors refused to cross the picket line in support of the striking writers, so the ceremony has been canceled. And as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports, that's been a costly decision.
Cancellation of the Golden Globes means more than just a good time loss for the celebrities involved and fans that like to watch them. Jack Kaiser, chief economist for the L.A. County Development Corporation, says some serious money has just gone down the drain.
The Golden Globes, a normal ceremony, will generate about $60 million for the L.A. County economy.
Kaiser says besides the show's actual production costs, there are other expenses.
Studio spending on ad campaigns, star perks, in-town parties.
Because all the major parties associated with the Globes have been canceled, Kaiser says a lot of people who never appear in movies or on television will also be feeling the pain.
The banquet staff at the Beverly Hilton and the people serving at all the parties, because they can generate a lot of tip income. Limo services, people providing valet parking, security services, flower shops, even dermatologists.
Ooh, no Botox. Madeline Leonard manages Cloutier, a top-tier agency that provides stylists, hair, and makeup artists to Hollywood's A-list celebrities. With no famous clients to service for the Golden Globes, Leonard says the phones at Cloutier have been ominously silent.
Award show weekends are the busiest weekends of the year, and the Academy Awards and the Golden Globes have always been the two busiest weekends for hair and makeup.
One awards tradition is holding steady despite the fact that the Golden Globes have gone bust, and that's the swag suite. Swag stands for stuff we all get.
This one retails for about $6,000, so it's 18-karat gold diamonds and really unique.
Melissa Lemmer owns Silver Spoon, an entertainment marketing business. At Voda Spa in West Hollywood, celebs are happily shopping for freebies at long tables of jewelry, cosmetics, clothes, and accessories as Lemmer's security looks on. Lemmer says she felt obligated to support sponsors who've already shelled out for the event in the hopes that celebrities will be seen in their wares, eventually.
A lot of people, unfortunately, have pulled out of so many things. I mean, these people are losing so much money on advertising that for me to turn to all the sponsors and say, we're not doing it, that'd be a waste of their money. I can't do that to them.
One of Lemmer's celebrity guests would normally be too busy to be here. Melissa Rivers is usually coordinating last-minute details for red carpet coverage with her mother, Joan, heard here at last year's Golden Globes.
Mark Anthony and Jennifer Lopez, just another simple girl in a dress. How are you, Joan? Whose dress?
This is Marquesa.
This year, says Melissa, both Rivers ladies are staying home.
My mother has not crossed a picket line. She has not done any of the shows that have had picket lines in front of them, and you have to support the people that have supported you all those years, and Writers Guild was the first guild she ever belonged to.
Performer support of the writers pretty much guaranteed the show wouldn't go on. It's meant that NBC has lost several million dollars in advertising, that magazines like Us and InStyle won't have the award show fashion coverage their readers crave. It means that restaurants and clubs that normally do very well being rented out for private parties won't receive that income. If there's a silver lining to the Globe's wreckage, Cloutier's Madeline Leonard says it might be this.
I think it's kind of a wake-up call, and it will push people to resolve this prior to the Oscars.
Which are 6 short weeks from now. Not that anybody's counting. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Last week, we asked listeners to tell us stories about their own elections. This one came in from our backyard.
Hi, I'm Tony Ward. I live in Kensington, Maryland. And my first election came about as a result of the Second World War starting.
It was 1941, and Tony Ward was in the first grade, 6 years old. Her father had struggled through the Depression, but finally found a steady job. The family had just moved to Maryland that November.
I have a vivid memory of December the 7th because my brother and I were sitting on the stairs And suddenly there was crying, the radio was going, and everybody gathered around the radio, and we understood that a war had started.
The next day at school, there was a lot of talk about what that meant. And then Toni Ward was elected by her peers and her first grade teacher to hold office.
My first election was as chair of the war bond drive at Glenmont Elementary School in Wheaton, Maryland.
She remembers carefully collecting the pennies that most children brought in. The coins purchased stamps, and the stamps accumulated until the children had enough to trade in for a war bond.
Oh, I felt so responsible. And I think I probably made lists of names and how much money and went over and over just like I was a bookkeeper. It was really a big thing in my life. I think I thought about it a lot when I wasn't at school.
Toni Ward now works in a school. She teaches special education, still in Maryland. But back then, shortly after heading up the war bond drive, her family had to move again. She was thrust into a new school in a new state. But she brought with her a sense of confidence from that first experience holding office. For next week's homework assignment, I want you to tell me about the character you find most memorable. It can be someone from a novel you've read or a favorite film. Tell me all about it and why. Write us. The address is homework@npr.org, or you can call the homework hotline 202-408-5183. You never know when we're going to play your message from the homework hotline. And we could not resist playing you one more submission from our election assignment. It's the campaign jingle from listener Martha Karatz of Indianapolis, Indiana. In a bid to be class secretary, here's how she once courted the vote of her fellow seventh graders.
I'm going to sit right down and write you all a letter and ask you all to vote for me. I'm going to write words oh so sweet, so efficient and so neat. All the I's I'll dot them, on the line I'll sign them. I'm going to sit right down and write you all a letter, so all you folks can plainly see that I'm the one who writes the better letter. And I should be your secretary. I lost the election.
Thank you, Martha Karatz, for bravely leaving this message on our homework hotline.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. In 1 week, all questions will be answered, at least regarding the new movie from J.J. Abrams, the guy behind the TV shows Lost and Alias. His new film will be in theaters in just 7 days. And as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, his fans on the internet are more than ready.
Even the movie's name was the subject of rampant internet speculation. It was called the Untitled J.J. Abrams Project. Fans thought Cloverfield was a fake name designed to throw them off. Cloverfield is an oddly pastoral title for a movie in which a giant monster rips the head off the Statue of Liberty.
What is it? Is it coming this way?
I saw it. It's alive. It's huge.
They've been marketing this film brilliantly.
Box office analyst Jeff Bock says Cloverfield's first theatrical trailer last summer showed little more than a few dramatic minutes captured on a handheld camera.
I mean, it was a really gutsy move to not even use a tag for the title. So the only thing you saw was the Cinema Verite video footage, and at the end, numbers 1-18-08.
Those numbers, the release date, the only clue for curious fans like Dennis Acevedo.
We took screenshots of every frame of the trailer and looked for clues inside the trailer.
The trailer started innocently with a party. By the end, all the guests are wandering the streets of New York in terror. Hundreds of YouTube videos obsessively analyze every minute.
When watching the trailer again, there's one scene. Very clearly hung on the wall is a board with the letters AKM listed on it, which is obviously the abbreviation of Alpha Kappa Mu.
Obviously. This video is by Tom Simmons, a 19-year-old forestry student who lives with his parents in England. He devoted himself to the arcania of the character's MySpace pages and websites planted by the studios online. He figured fellow fans might benefit from his research.
Putting up a YouTube video seemed like the obvious thing to do. and it got enough views.
Over 10,000 of them. Some analysts compare the Cloverfield phenomenon to a recent box office disappointment, New Line's Snakes on a Plane.
What New Line got wrong was that people, yes, were chatting about this film in online communities, but really they were making fun of the film.
Exhibitor relations Jeff Bach says an online campaign for the star to utter one expletive-laden line about snakes and planes did not mean people actually wanted to pay $10 to see a mediocre action film. Cloverfield lured fans down a narrative rabbit hole by creating a whole universe online. Dennis Acevedo's guide to it is called CloverfieldClues.com. It helped lead fans to studio-produced news reports about a monster attacking New York.
There was a Japanese and Spanish and German and Italian and English and even a Russian video. You have all these theories about what's going to happen in the movie, and then you start to see all these different videos come out, and it just really builds up the excitement for the movie.
I asked Tom Simmons, the British forestry student, if he minded being co-opted into a marketing strategy.
Never really thought about it like that. I mean, yeah, obviously they are creating an incredible amount of interest about a film without spending much money at all. But they deserve it, really. I mean, I don't mind it, as long as the film's good.
The movie doesn't come out in England until February, so he's going to scrupulously avoid the fan sites until then. When he sees the movie, Simmons says he wants it to be fresh. No surprises. Neda Ulaby, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Hollywood is consumed with the writer's strike right now, but even when it's resolved, the television networks will still have their troubles. The audience is shrinking, and the traditional model for making money is breaking down. And as NPR's Kim Masters reports, it's become very, very expensive to make one of the signature products of a big network, the hour-long primetime drama.
On Sunday night, Fox is taking a big, action-packed roll of the dice. The new show, Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Nothing matters anymore. Only the boy. The future's ours. And it begins now.
It's the familiar Terminator concept. Mom struggles to save her child from grim, time-traveling cyborgs.
29 Baker, take one.
Guys, hit the ledge every now and then with your flashlights. That would be good. Thank you, guys. Here we go. Rolling sound.
In a Los Angeles park on a Friday afternoon, 19-year-old Thomas Decker, who plays young John Connor, waits to shoot a scene. The size of the crew would seem more worthy of a big film than a single television episode. The magnitude of the operation impresses even Decker, who's been acting since he was 5 and has credits ranging from Seinfeld to Heroes.
The budget on this show is definitely, for everything, is massive. I mean, it's huge. It's a very expensive show.
All the networks are caught up in pursuit of a costly, effects-packed hit. That's because of the success of shows like Lost and Heroes, says James Hibbard, a writer with TV Week.
They keep setting the bar higher for what viewers expect.
Bigger special effects are only part of the equation. There's the skyrocketing price of talent, actors, writers, producers. Mark Graboff is co-chairman of NBC Entertainment. He says it now costs about $4 million to make one episode of an hour-long drama. Sitcoms have gotten more expensive, too, and that's transformed primetime. 10 years ago, Graboff says, NBC could pack its schedule with scripted programs.
Can't do that anymore. No network can do that. I don't care what anybody tells you. Just can't do it anymore.
Because as costs are rising, the audience is shrinking, lured away to the internet. Hits are more elusive than ever. Already this season, the networks have failed with a number of new big-ticket programs. CBS canceled Viva Laughlin after one airing. ABC has had only modest success with Pushing Daisies, and NBC struck out with Bionic Woman. Mark Graboff says something must change.
We got to keep our programming costs under check, or else we're out of business.
Networks are looking for ways to save, on shooting pilots, for one thing. For many years, each one has made 20 to 30 each season. They keep getting more expensive, and still, most never even get on the air.
Maybe you, instead of going to pilot, you order 6 scripts, and you read the show, and you go, okay, they have a show here. You go write the series. You save yourselves a lot of money.
Of course, approving a show without ever seeing what it looks like is risky, too. But NBC has done it with one upcoming series. The philanthropist is from an established player, Tom Fontana, who produced Homicide, Life on the Street. Another way to save, of course, is cheaper shows. NBC has ordered a block of programming modeled on shows like the History Channel's Ice Road Truckers, people doing tough jobs in extreme conditions. That kind of program might not draw a big audience, but Graboff says the price is right.
If we can get shows for under $500,000 an hour, the bar is much lower for what the ratings need to be. You can get closer to cable ratings.
Still, Graboff says NBC can't swear off big, pricey dramas entirely.
They're bigger bets, but you got to take them from time to time to consider yourself a broadcast network. You still have to do things like that.
Graboff says the network will try to offer just enough of the high-priced stuff to hold on to some brand identity, to distinguish NBC from a cable channel.
We care deeply about the image of NBC and the brand of NBC, such as it is, but we also understand the economic realities are different now than they've ever been.
NBC is contemplating other cost-cutting changes, questioning, for example, whether it has to shell out millions at the Upfronts, an annual event in New York during which the networks woo advertisers with lavish parties. It's not clear how far the networks will go in breaking with tradition. What is clear is that resolving the writers' strike doesn't mean the networks can go back to business as usual. NBC's Mark Graboff.
In a world that's on demand, where people watch what they want, where they want, how they want, and when they want, okay, then what is NBC? What is any network?
And to a network executive, that question is just about as scary as cyborgs from the future. Kim Masters, NPR News.